Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Bonus Episode 2, The Origins of the Trinity, with Dr. Michael Heiser. As promised a few months ago, I have been working on a bonus episode for the podcast. Our next episode in the First Three Centuries series will discuss the Trinity and Christology. A couple of you have asked me about the origins and roots of Trinitarian theology. I think many of you will find fascinating what our guest has to say on this. I know I certainly did when I came across his and other scholars' work in this area. Our guest is Dr. Michael Heiser. Dr. Heiser holds a PhD in Hebrew and Semitic Studies from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is the scholar in residence for Logos Bible Software. He has also taught at various academic institutions and currently teaches at Liberty University and Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. In 2010, he started Memra, an online institute that provides courses in ancient languages, including Biblical Hebrew and Greek. He also runs the non-for-profit corporation Miklat, which aims at providing serious biblical content for modern-day Christians. Dr. Heiser is also the author of numerous books and articles, including The Unseen Realm, Recovering the Supernatural Worldview of the Bible, and The Bible Unfiltered, Approaching Scripture on Its Own Terms. He also runs various websites, including The Divine Council, Two Powers in Heaven, as well as The Naked Bible blog and its associated The Naked Bible podcast. Dr. Heiser, welcome to the History of the Early Church podcast.
Well, thanks for having me.
So I wanted to start out by asking you, what got you into podcasting?
Oh, that's a good question. I ask myself that all the time. I just found the format appealing and thought, I mean, I had enough requests to do something, you know, some kind of teaching, and I thought, well, this looks easy. It probably isn't a lot of work. And of course, I discovered I was wrong. But I guess just a good way to disseminate content, and I quit my own podcast after 33 episodes because it was work. But fortunately, someone came along and from my audience and rescued me and did the work for me.
Well, I just want to say thank you for both the podcast and all that you do to put out such great content and engage with, you know, the interested layperson. There's not enough of that out there, and I really commend you for doing that.
Well, thank you, and as you know, I agree.
So kind of moving into our main topic, so just kind of a bit of context. We are, the History of the Early Church podcast is about telling a chronological narrative of early Christianity from Pentecost up to the Council of Chalcedon in the mid-5th century. And right now we've reached the end of the 3rd century. So we're right at that hinge point between, you know, kind of the early Christian centuries and late antiquity. And so before we, you know, get into the big events of the 4th century, you know, the persecution of Diocletian, the rise of Constantine, Nicaea, Arius, all that stuff, we're taking an extended break from the narrative to kind of focus on specific topics in a way we, you know, couldn't do in a narrative format. And our next episode will be on the Trinity and Christology in the early church. And as I've followed your work for quite some time now, and one of the things that your work introduced me to that made me realize that the roots of these theological ideas go much farther back than I ever would have thought is the concepts of the divine council in ancient Canaanite and Israelite religion, and also the related idea of the two powers in heaven in Second Temple Judaism. So I was wondering if you could just talk a bit about the divine council in Canaanite and Israelite religion.
Yeah, the divine council is academies for God and his heavenly host. The terminology isn't a contrivance, because Scripture itself uses these kinds of terms in Psalm 82, Psalm 89, congregation council terminology with plural Elohim in the case of Psalm 82, verse 1. You know, Elohim, Nitzav Ba'adat El, God, capital G, stands in the divine council. And we know it's a singular God because of the grammar. Nitzav is a singular participle. And then the second half of the verse says, Bekerav Elohim Yishpot, in the midst of the gods, in the midst of the Elohim, he passes or holds judgment or passes judgment. So, you know, you have this kind of language, this divine plurality language in a scene that uses a word like council or assembly. You get on to verse 6, and the plural Elohim that's repeated in verse 6, and the plural Elohim are referred to as sons of the Most High, which is the God of the Bible in biblical thinking. And so you take that, sons of God or Elohim, over to Psalm 89, you get another reference to the B'nai Elohim, B'nai Elim, in the council of the holy ones. Okay, so this is where this language comes from. You have divine council scenes, scenes in the throne room of God, where God is surrounded by the heavenly host, and they participate in some way in decision-making or carrying out decrees. So it on one level, it's kind of normal to think of God and his heavenly host. There's, you know, no surprise there. But on the other hand, you get this deity language, or what some people would say deity language, Elohim in the plural, that gets sort of thrown into the mix. And again, I don't believe that we have polytheism in the Hebrew Bible, at least by the biblical writers. I reject the notion that the biblical writers would have been polytheists, and then they evolved toward the latter part, or, you know, of the exile, into monotheists. That's sort of the dominant critical position, and I think it's based on circular reasoning, so I don't believe that. But I do believe they understood what they meant by this language, that Yahweh was one of the Elohim, but no other Elohim was Yahweh. And you don't get that theology by virtue of a term like Elohim. You get it from the way that particular Elohim, Yahweh, the God of Israel, is described. He's described in unique ways that no other Elohim is ever described. And so that kind of thing, you know, you're getting into this language of pantheon, talking about divine plurality. That's what feels new to people. And I think in part because, you know, we have these passages mediated to us in English translation, but also because, you know, our modern church traditions tend to, you know, sort of cancel that out with the way they talk about certain points of Old Testament theology, that they're not terribly careful in creeds and whatnot to talk about these sorts of passages. And on one level, that's understandable, because creeds have to condense things and, you know, pick out the most important ideas that define you know, the core of the Christian faith. So on one hand, it's understandable, but on the other hand, when people encounter it in the text, they are prone to either ignore it or make up some, you know, because it takes some position on it that doesn't work real well, or just, you know, sort of mess it up. But the early the early Jewish community, I mean, there's a whole field in biblical studies on Jewish Christological monotheism, where these texts become part of the matrix of ideas on how, you know, we should read the Hebrew Bible, how divine plurality as a concept helped inform thinking, you know, of the Jewish community in the intertestamental or Second Temple period, and then how Jesus was thought about and framed. And if I could add one more thought, yeah, in my dissertation, I don't get into this specific point too much in the Unseen Realm, which is a book that I'm sort of known for now. But in a published journal article, I take the view that the structure of the Canaanite Divine Council, which had two deities at the top, you had El and Baal, that structure, you know, two slots, was adapted or talked about differently in the Israelite, the biblical, the Orthodox biblical way of talking about council, where Yahweh occupied both slots. There was a transcendent, invisible Yahweh, and then Yahweh as a man in the Hebrew Bible, just generally. And so that sort of prepped people centuries later to think about things like Godhead. When you had this sort of structural thing going on, Yahweh as a man, but that Yahweh is the same as the transcendent Yahweh, but yet they're different characters. So kind of the way that Christians, you know, struggle to talk about the relationship of Jesus and the Father, I take the view that the phenomena of the text in various regards sort of prepared people to have that conversation and to parse some of the things that Jesus and New Testament writers were saying.
So kind of looking at specifics, what are some specific passages where we see this idea of two Yahwehs in the Hebrew Bible? The one in particular that comes to my mind that Justin Martyr in his dialogue with Trifo references a lot is Genesis 18 and 19.
Yeah, that's a good one, because you have, you know, the three quote unquote men that meet with Abraham and share a meal in Genesis 18, and you find that two of them, you know, go to Sodom and they're referred to as angels, and then the third party in the little group remains behind and converses with Abraham, and you get at one point, you know, the divine name used of that person. So that one is sort of a bit more obvious than others. You know, you have Yahweh anthropomorphized in various passages, like, you know, the word of the Lord came to me. We have it in Genesis 15. We have it in 1 Samuel 3. We have it in Jeremiah 1, where the word of the Lord is anthropomorphized. And in the case of Jeremiah, there's like a tactile experience that goes along with it. The word of the Lord, who is named as Yahweh in the passage, reached out his hand and touched me. So you have scenes like that where Yahweh is sort of mediated or filtered for people as a man in these conversations. You have Exodus 15, which was a big passage in the rabbinic discussion of the two powers in heaven, where, you know, the Lord is a man, Yahweh is a man of war. So you have anthropomorphic imagery there. So it typically comes from Yahweh being anthropomorphized, and then the anthropomorphized figure will at some point be either blurred with or distinguished from. You have both things happen, the angel of the Lord. And so you get this, again, situation where you have two figures that are different, but they're both spoken of, and in some cases both called the same thing. You know, the angel, you know, comes to Jacob and says things that are point blank, like, I am the God of Bethel. And critical scholars like to say, well, that's what a messenger would say. A messenger represents somebody else. So the angel represents the deity, and so the angel or the messenger gets to talk in the first person. Well, that's nice until you hit Genesis 48, and that's Jacob's deathbed blessing, where he's blessing the two sons of Joseph. And again, we're familiar with the story that crosses his arms and all that stuff that we get in Sunday school. But if you actually look, you know, at the blessing formula itself, it's kind of significant, you know, the way things are actually put, you know, in the biblical text. We have, you know, Jacob says in his prayer, you know, he blessed Joseph and said, the God, that's Ha Elohim, before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked. Second stanza is, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day. Again, Ha Elohim. And then the third stanza, you expect to see Ha Elohim again, but that's not what you get. You get Ha Malach, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil. Bless the boys. May he bless the boys. And the kicker here is, bless is grammatically singular. So it's not proper to say, may they bless the boys. It's very clearly in the text, may he bless the boys. And so here you have a good example of the God, you know, who is the Lord in all these episodes, Yahweh, the divine name in these episodes of Jacob's life, is aligned even grammatically or blurred. The distinction is blurred very, you know, a lot, you know, very effectively with the angel. And it was passages like these that sort of merge the two or blur the two or co-identify the two, but yet they're still different, you know, figures in other passages. And, you know, again, this view isn't original to me. It you know, Jewish, you know, thinkers notice these sorts of things, you know, all the way through. In this particular instance, we don't have an angel speaking for a superior. We have Jacob's estimation and Scripture's estimation of these episodes in Jacob's life. So we can't get away with just saying this is messenger language and dismissing the first person. It just doesn't work here. So you have, if these things get noticed by the Jewish community and they become part of the matrix of ideas that leads to what Judaism used to call the two powers in heaven theology. And it's important, again, to frame the discussion that will follow when it comes to Christology.
So what are some of the ways that in the Second Temple period we see Jews interpreting these passages?
Yeah, there's a bunch of candidates. If your audience is interested in the subject, I would recommend, and thankfully this book, which used to be $200 in hardcover, is now available in paperback for $40. But Charles Geeshan, his book, Angelomorphic Christology, and it's basically a sort of a history of the idea. The subtitle is Antecedents and Early Evidence, and he goes through the Second Temple period and chronicles, you know, well, what did they do with this stuff? I mean, what was the discussion? And so what you find is there were lots of candidates for who the second Yahweh figure was, and they can break down into two categories. You have sort of exalted humans from the Old Testament that sort of get elevated to a deified status. And then the other category is a particular angel. So in the human category, there are Second Temple period Jewish texts that talk about Adam or Jacob or Moses or Abraham, you know, somebody like that has sort of been deified and kind of has this exalted status in heaven alongside Yahweh. They're famous texts, Ezekiel the Tragedian, which is a pseudepigraphical text in the Second Temple period, has Moses, you know, God inviting Moses to sit down on his throne, you know, kind of try it out, share the throne here a little bit. So they were speculating on how you could get this two thing, this two-ness with Yahweh going on. And on the angelic side, you'd have the obvious candidates would be Michael. You know, Gabriel gets a few votes, you know, in Second Temple Jewish literature to be the second Yahweh figure. You get toward the end of the first century, you know, toward the end of the Second Temple period, you've got references to the second god, Deuteron Theon, in the writings of Josephus. You have a particular angel in Second Enoch referred to as Yahoel. So it has the divine name, the angel bears the divine name Yah, and Yahoel actually combines Yahweh and El. And it's kind of shocking to see a Jewish writer talking about a second god or naming an angel with the divine name. So you get different candidates depending on the writer, but they were noticing the features of the text, and it was perfectly legitimate for them to talk about it. And it was part of their Hebrew Bible, so it became part of their theology, and it became, you know, good grist for the mill, you know, fodder for speculation. It wasn't off limits until, as Alan Siegel's work shows, and Siegel wrote the book Two Powers in Heaven, it became a heresy in the second century. And he ties in that development where Judaism changed their theology in response to both Christian theology. You know, Christ, of course, Jesus became the second power for the Christian community, the second Yahweh figure, and also some early Gnostic ideas. So Judaism just shut the door on this point of their own theological history in the second century.
What are some of the ways we see the New Testament engaging with the two powers idea?
Yeah, that usually happens with, you'll have New Testament writers do a variety of things. They will, again, if you're familiar with the two powers, the two Yahweh stuff from the Old Testament, there would be things that stand out. For instance, in Jude, Jesus is the one who leads the Israelites out of Egypt and into the Promised Land, whereas in the Old Testament, depending on what passage you're looking at, it's either Yahweh who does that, or Elohim does that, or the Panim, the presence of God, does that, or the angel, like in Judges chapter 2, does that. Well, for the New Testament writer, it's Jesus. So you get this sort of conceptual link. There's something in the Old Testament, Old Testament scholars refer to as the name theology. The name Hashem in Hebrew is a circumlocution, another way of referring to God himself. The name resides in a particular angel. In Exodus 23, the angel that takes them to the Promised Land. So you get name theology applied to this angel figure, again, in human form. And the name is God, but he's in this angel. So, God tells Moses in Exodus 23, I'm going to send this angel. So God is referring to the angel in the third person, but then he says, you better listen to him. He won't pardon your transgressions because my name is in him. And it distinguishes this angel from other angels. What's the distinction? Well, I'm in him. That's me. I'm here, but that's me over there too. And then you get Jesus in the New Testament, like in the high priestly prayer, talking about how he revealed the name to those God had given him. Well, everybody knows what God's name is. They have a Bible. They can just go look it up. But so what he means is that he's not showing up to say, hey, the name of the Lord is Yahweh. It's these four consonants. Instead, he's talking about how he himself revealed who God was. You have seen me, you have seen the Father. It's that kind of idea. So you'll get New Testament writers repurpose Old Testament motifs and even some passages that deal in some way with the second Yahweh figure and then apply it to Jesus.
You mentioned earlier about the word of the Lord appearing as something visual that prophets in the Old Testament would see. Is that kind of the background to the Gospel of John's use or referring to Jesus as the Word of God?
Yeah, I think it is. And I would never say that every time you run into the phrase Word of the Lord in the Old Testament that we're dealing with a visual event. But there are certainly a number of instances where you are dealing with a visual event, and because the text, pretty much says that, point blank. It starts in Genesis with Abraham, but there are other passages that are just really, again, I think kind of, I don't want to make a pun here, but kind of transparent. In Genesis 15, you get, after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Well, the profound moment there is realizing that, hey, visions are things you see. Okay, visions aren't invisible, they're visions. Okay, you see things in visions. And so here we have the word of the Lord coming visually. You get it in 1 Samuel 3. Again, we were like another familiar Sunday school story where Samuel is awakened and Eli, after the second time, says, hey, if he comes again, say, speak, Lord, your servant hears. And if you look at what the passage actually says, it begins with saying, the word of the Lord was rare in those days. There was no frequent vision, and visions are things that you see. Verse 7, the word of the Lord had not yet been revealed to Samuel. Again, you get vision language. Verse 10, Yahweh comes and he stands. The Lord came and stood as at the other times, calling Samuel's name. So you wouldn't describe an invisible thing or a sound in your head as standing. This is the language of a visual experience. And the chapter ends. Samuel grew. The Lord was with him. Everybody knows that Samuel's a prophet. Why? Verse 21 at the end of the chapter. Because the Lord, Yahweh, divine name, appeared again at Shiloh. The Lord revealed himself to Samuel as the word of the Lord. then Jeremiah, again, you have the same kind of language. So, you know, this becomes the backdrop for John's, you know, statements. I'm not one to say that John has nothing to do with the wider, you know, Greco-Roman world. I mean, I'm not going to be categorical like that. But I actually just chuckle when I run across, you know, commentators that talk about how his doctrine of the word is Platonic, this and that, and, you know, appealing to, you know, Greco-Roman pagan writers for this or that concept, or even Philo. No, John has a pretty good grasp of certain ideas found in certain passages in his Old Testament. That's where you'd expect him to find it. So we don't have to go really any further than the Hebrew Bible to establish this idea. And again, if your audience is interested in this kind of thing, there's a good book. I don't really get into this too much in Unseen Realm either, but there's a good book by Ronning, R-O-N-N-I-N-G, on the Targum and the Logos idea. Because it's really fascinating that you'll find in the Aramaic Targums, which, again, there's no reason to suspect that John would not have been exposed to them, because the Old Testament Targums, you know, are going to be around in some form, you know, in the first century, but they will often use the word memra in Aramaic, which means word, as a way of referring to either a second Yahweh figure, or they will insert the memra in a passage to try to help the reader discern what's going on here with God. Usually when God gets this anthropomorphic language, they'll insert the word memra in there. And it's just an idea that the word was in human form, but yet was still God, or associated intimately with God. You know, in the first century, this would not have been a blazingly new idea to people in the early church, Jews who were being confronted with, you know, the claims of the apostles and Jesus himself. This would have been territory that they had some familiarity with, again, presuming that they've had exposure to Second Temple period writings, you know, assuming they're literate. But they could have heard the stories as well, you know, like Samuel and 1 Samuel 3. So this isn't an innovation. It's not brand new. It actually builds on something older.
A kind of related figure I wanted to ask you about is the figure of wisdom, especially in the book of Proverbs. I've been reading a little ahead on the Arian controversy, and Proverbs 8:20, especially verses 22 and 25, were certainly battleground passages of controversy. I'm curious what your thoughts on that are.
Yeah, I mean, the issue revolves around what is the meaning, or the semantic range, anyway, of kana, the Hebrew verb in Proverbs 8:22, because depending on your English translation, that'll be worded like the Lord created me at the beginning of his work, or the Lord possessed me at the beginning of his work, something like that. And wisdom is the character in Proverbs 8:22 through 31. And we've seen wisdom before in the book of Proverbs. So we know this is a personified, you know, character, a personified concept, or really portrayed as a character here. And when you get to 22, you know, did the Lord create wisdom? And the question is important, because if you keep reading down the passage, wisdom is present before, you know, the foundations of the earth. And depending on how you translate verse 30, wisdom is the speaker. I was beside him, God, like a master workman. I was his daily delight, rejoicing before him and in the inhabited world, delighting in the children of men. So you have this co-creator possibility. And for people familiar with the New Testament, it's like, well, that's the way Jesus gets talked about. He's the agent of creation. Who's this wisdom? And good grief, you know, it's a woman. You know, what do we do with that? So it generated lots of discussion, but the gender issue, I think, is easy, because if you know anything about grammatical gender, it's just a form of classification, the way we align verbs and nouns. The bigger issue is the meaning of kana. Does it mean create or not? And it certainly can. There are at least one or two other verses where create maybe in view. I'm thinking of Deuteronomy 32:6. There's one in Psalm 139. But you could, even in those passages, translate it as possessed. The issue is, for me, this is just me speaking now, it seems really odd to think that the Lord created wisdom before his creative activity, because that sort of suggests that there was a time when God lacked wisdom. And I don't know how you square that with the portrait of the God of the Old Testament. Because if this is a personified attribute of Yahweh, then at one point he didn't have that attribute. So how would he be smart enough to say, hey, I need wisdom, let's create that, and then I can use it? It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But there were people, who fought for the creation language there in the Christological debates, because the wisdom figure was part of the Jesus discussion, in the Arian controversy. Wisdom is a figure as well in Second Temple Judaism. Wisdom takes her place next to God in the divine council, shares the throne and all this kind of stuff. But for Jews, Jewish interpretation typically saw wisdom as the Torah. And they argued that the Torah was, either the first of God's great works, or some would even say the Torah was eternal. So they're going with that because Chokmah, wisdom, is feminine in gender, and Torah is also a feminine noun. So that was their exegetical justification for seeing wisdom as Torah. And the Torah is wisdom because it's instruction, that kind of exegesis. So it there's a long debate behind this that really, again, I just don't think create works well here because of the attributes of God himself in the Old Testament. I don't really need the Christological push, to think create doesn't make a whole lot of sense here. So I tell students, I used to assign this passage when I did distance ed in seminary, and I'd say, look, what you need is you need to do exegesis here so that you don't insert your Christology into Proverbs 8, but Proverbs 8 has to have its own coherence, to make it a legitimate interpretation. And I just don't think it's coherent to have God lack wisdom at any point.
Yeah. That's fascinating how this, this discussions about the Trinity in the early church stretch all the way back into the time of ancient Israel and ancient Canaan. Do you know, off the top of your head, what, you said the Hebrew verb was kana?
Yeah.
Do you know what that was translated as in the old Greek? Since, obviously that'd be the text that, Athanasius and Arius would be working from.
I'd have to look it up. I mean, I can do that now quickly if you want, unless you've already looked it up.
No, I haven't. I was curious.
Yeah, I'm wondering if I have access. I mean, it's Septuagint's, but I don't know if that's necessarily the reading that Athanasius would have had. Let me just take a stab at it here. This doesn't really translate well to radio. Here we go. We'll go with Rolf's edition. Again, there's for those listening out there to this wonderful portion here. There's more than one text of the Septuagint. So you have, let's see here. It's ketidzo, so it would have been at least in this text, you'd have one of the normal lemmas for create, at least in this edition of the Septuagint. I don't have a critical apparatus here in front of me. Although, let's just take a stab at this too. We are in Proverbs. My Gerdingen is not producing Proverbs, which maybe that volume doesn't exist. Who knows? Do you have the Gerdingen Septuagint memorized? Which volumes are available or not?
Nope.
Yeah. No, I'm going through the table of contents here, and I don't see one for Proverbs. So, yeah, I couldn't tell you off the top of my head here what the variants are there, if there are any.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, I was just kind of curious about that. Because, yeah, you're right. That was one thing that I learned pretty quickly in researching the last episode, that there is no really the Septuagint. It's a hodgepodge of lots of different Greek translations.
Yep.
That was part one of my interview with Dr. Michael Heiser. The second half focuses on angels and demons, which I will release in the near future prior to our episode on early Christian beliefs about the supernatural world. I hope you all found this episode informative and interesting. I also hope this helps lay some of the groundwork for our next episode on the Trinity and Christology. I've posted links to Dr. Heiser's material up on the blog site. I highly encourage all of you to check out his work and the Naked Bible podcast. If you enjoy the history of the early church, then you'll certainly enjoy the Naked Bible podcast. As always, thank you for listening, and thank you so much to all of you who have sent me questions for these episodes. Please keep sending in your questions and requests by emailing me at historyoftheearlychurch@gmail.com, commenting on the Facebook page, facebook.com/earlychurchpodcast, or commenting on the blog site, historyoftheearlychurch.wordpress.com.